Welcome to the Applied Blockchain Podcast, where blockchain technology and innovation are in the spotlight. My name is Adi Benari, and I'm the founder and CEO of Applied Blockchain, and I'll be your host as we dive into relaxed conversations with industry experts and thought leaders to get their views on what they're building, the Web3 ecosystem, and its transformative impact on the modern world. Chris Romo, welcome to the Applied Blockchain Podcast.
Hey, it is a real pleasure. So happy to be here.
So, Chris, tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got into the space, etc.
Yeah, so you know, so one day I woke up and I was in the world. No, I'm kind of interesting story. You know, I'm a lawyer by training, but even before I was a lawyer, I actually went to graduate school. So I'm one of actually what are a number of people here in the United States who are in like the sort of blockchain space, who actually have like humanities backgrounds of all things, right? You know, like I actually lived overseas and I went to graduate school in like basically history and foreign languages and stuff like that. And I knew a whole lot of like German of all things. Then I go to law school. And when I was in law school, I was focused in almost entirely on business because I kind of spent a lot of time thinking about sort of things that happened in the past, and I was very sort of forward leaning, like to think about, well, what kinds of solutions can be built to all of these different kinds of issues? And I knew that a lot of it was built on figuring out financing and how to get capital to places where it would be most productive and the like. And then I lived over in London for the first stint of my career over in Moorgate, working for a US law firm, Cravath, Swaine & Moore. And then I ended up being sort of pulled to the academy because I had like big ideas about like architecting different kinds of things. I was very much interested in all things international, international movement of money, international trade. And then I was on loan to the SEC in this year where nothing ever happens, 2008. and then I got really, you know, I was supposed to be a kind of leisurely position over at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, where I was supposed to be kind of on loan a little bit, thinking about like my big scholarship before getting tenure. All hell breaks loose in the financial system, and I got to sort of see up close how regulators deal with finance. And a part of that work that I was doing involved some, you know, financial technology, things called credit rating agencies, and you know what happened. You know, with the credit rating agencies over in 2008 and what happens, you know, when shares of different stocks are being traded in different parts of the world. So if you don't want short selling in one infrastructure, what happens when that short selling just migrates to another platform? And I started to really think a lot about, you know, it's interesting. We talk about base layer infrastructures, and I always talk about law as one of those very important base layer infrastructures, but also sort of technology, and then that.
Nice. I love that, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, because it all operates a lot. You know, like you have to actually build like legal tools, and even though they may be in your mind, they're just as real as like technology, as nuts and bolts, right? And I was really, really sort of interested in that stuff. And then in the aftermath of the financial crisis, we had a situation where the banks weren't lending very much money. I'm now old enough to be able to sort of see history repeat itself in different kinds of ways. And back then, the response was like crowdfunding, if you can recall, and like the Jobs Act in the United States to sort of figure out, is there a way that we can harness the internet to kind of funnel capital to companies that we're not getting the kind of capital that they would normally be getting from large financial institutions or from banks. And that then catalyzed later, you know, when you get into crowdfunding and like, I'm the one, you know, one of the, unfortunately, like OGs in that kind of space, you know, from the legal standpoint of thinking about crowdfunding, and then moving into things like fundraisers of all sorts, from microfinance all the way to, you know, this new thing that I saw, you know, on blockchains. Like, okay, now this is kind of interesting. Now, you know, they're calling it something, you know, ICO, or sometimes, you know, combining some things with airdrops or whatever it is. But I'm looking at it from my background as sort of someone who's too old, I guess.
No, we're fundraising. These tokens have a use, right? That's a, yeah. I'm kidding, man.
No. Exactly. It's like, it's not that, yeah. But you know, it was just very interesting, sort of as a lawyer. And you know, in between then, I spent a ton of time on fintech. And there's like a, I don't know if you guys have the Four Dummies books, like you know. Yeah. Yeah, well, we have like a version for that for lawyers in the United States, and they're called like nutshell books. Like, so I'm the author literally of like the fintech law in a nutshell. So it's like fintech law for dummies kind of thing. So when I got it to get started to get more interested in sort of, you know, blockchains and crypto and like what it meant for like monetary systems and capital markets and securities law, it was an immediate kind of fit for me based off of everything that I had been doing. And pretty early on, I was very involved in that. And I was called into Congress a number of times to testify, you know, for Libra and all that other kind of stuff. And really since then, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, emerging tech, I guess, my career has been basically emerging technologies and the law. Right.
Right, and now you're a professor of law at Georgetown.
Yes. Right?
Yeah.
I'm a professor over at Georgetown, and I run something called the Institute of International Economic Law. I teach financial technology and the law. I teach financial regulation. I teach securities regulation, so you know, the Howey test kind of class. I have a big conference that I throw every year called DC FinTech Week. It started off super small, but now it's probably the biggest fintech policy conference in the United States. I advise different kinds of companies in the space, and I sit on, you know, boards of small, tiny startups all the way to Fannie Mae, which is the sort of backbone of the U.S. housing market.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Chris, let me ask you a simple but loaded question, right? When people ask me about blockchain and the potential and where's all this going and so on, my usual answer is the tech's fine, right? The tech's kind of ready.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the legals and regs that we're kind of still waiting on, right?
Yeah.
what's your view on all this? Like, where are we with all this from your perspective?
You know, it really depends on where in the world you are. You know, you know, every country has its own values, for sure, right? And so, and its own legal system. Every country has its own degree of or different kinds of legacy players that impact the appetite that regulators and the market, you know, may have in upstart technologies. And you know, because of that, it's really a patchwork. So you know, certainly in the United States, we've attracted our fair share of attention, you know, we are certainly a slow mover, and one that at this point is, you know, collectively, I think as a country, we're certainly not sure about where we want to go. And there's a lot of conflicting views, frankly, not only, you know, amongst policymakers and politicians and even regulators, but even in the market. You know, the crypto space is not exactly the most, you know, unified in interest in terms of how they view these things. So, but on the other hand, if you go to like Brazil, they're speeding ahead, not just, you know, with this Brazilian real, but they're like working with Aave and Uniswap and other kinds of companies on trying to think through, you know, a platform model for really moving into the sort of crypto ecosystem to develop new kinds of use cases, right? And Japan, right. Hong Kong, really different places. The UK is, I guess, one of those TBDs, to be determined.
Somewhere in the middle, I guess, yeah. Right? Chris, if it was completely up to you,
Oh no.
What would
no one wants that. No one wants
No, but it's a serious question, right? What would the regulation look like?
Again, you know, so I think mm-hmm. that one of the biggest challenges with emerging technologies is like, I don't want to sound too Donald Rumsfeldian, right? It's like there's the known knowns and the unknown knowns or the known unknowns or whatever it is, right? And you know, as a regulator, you're always, you know, I think it's useful for developers and for technologists to kind of understand at least the mentality of a regulator, right? Which you may not like or you may like, I don't know, but you have to understand sort of like the incentive structure for a regulator, which is, you know, I've never heard of all my years teaching and living in DC, I've never heard of someone go to a regulator and say, good job for enabling something to happen, particularly if it's a kind of a new or novel technology or feature. Mm-hmm. But if you let someone in and something goes wrong, you will be blamed, right? So there's really, you know, from a regulator standpoint, there's no real upside, unfortunately, you know, at least in most countries, and there's a lot of downside, right? So ideally, you'd want to find a regulatory system that's able to reconfigure the risk in a way that the regulator feels more comfort in enabling technologies that ultimately, you know, advance the economy, right? And so in my opinion, what I would like to see and what I've written about for years in the United States, and different countries have different ways of doing this, is to enable, you know, like, I guess, sandboxes are like, you know, almost hackneyed terms nowadays, but like no one's really, not enough attention is really put into thinking through what that would look like from the standpoint of incubating new technologies, getting developers and founders up to speed as to sort of what the, let's call it the legal base layer has to look like, right? Mm-hmm. And then also creating data points such that a regulator is not just shooting in the dark. Because when a regulator shoots in the dark, you know, the impulse will be, frankly, just to shut it down because there's risk. You just don't know what kind of havoc any particular technology is actually going to have for your ecosystem. But, you know, to have a kind of a toolbox, a regulatory toolbox that enables the incubation and acceleration of technologies and sort of, let's call it, the fact-finding missions of the regulators, while you're also enabling those new technologies and entrepreneurs to get to market quickly. I don't think that there's always a keen awareness of how hard it is to necessarily be an entrepreneur, you know, like when you get into this space. Yeah. I think that regulators who profess, you know, a desire to introduce competition, there's not always a full awareness as to how different policies entrench monopolistic or oligopolistic behavior, you know, so you have to sort of figure out, like, how do you make it worthwhile for the regulators while also making sure that the industry knows, like, look, you know, here are the rules you have to work with, but mm-hmm. view those rules as enabling, right? You understand and make sure that when there aren't rules that are not enabling, that you communicate those to your regulator. And so, you know, you know, my ideal regulatory system is one that incubates, accelerates, but also drives knowledge for the regulators so that they can create safety, you know, for those technologies, right? Mm-hmm. And for strong and thoughtful supervision. I mean, regulators have a really important job. I think one of the things that developers also don't necessarily understand sometimes is they'll criticize a rule, and very often the rule is wrong, or I won't say mm-hmm. wrong. Very often the rule is antiquated.
It's a blunt instrument, right?
It's a blunt instrument, yeah. Or it just doesn't apply to like the facts of society anymore, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But when you know, the the developer or the VC or the technologist or whoever it is, what they have to do is sort of say, you can't just sort of say, okay, that's an antiquated rule, so I want to kill the rule, right?
Yeah.
You kind of have to understand why was the rule there in the first place? Like what problem is the rule trying to address, right? Yeah. And then if as the entrepreneur or technologist or whatever, if you understand what that rule is trying to address, then you can make this argument and a really powerful one that says, maybe, you know, the technology that I have actually speaks to this rule even better than your rule does or something, right?
Yep. Let me throw a few thoughts your way around that. So first of all, in terms of like the testing environments for the regulators, I assume this is like the regulatory sandbox like we have in the UK, the FCA sandbox, which we've been through as well, and some of the companies we've worked with have been through. Then a few thoughts about this. So first of all, just what you're describing about the rules, I think about this in terms of companies as well, right? We're a relatively small company. We have some, you know, we had no processes or procedures in place when we started. Things went wrong. And so gradually we've layered on a few processes. If I go to a very large company, like some of our clients, there's so many processes that it's very difficult to move or maneuver, right?
Yes.
Because they've become so risk averse.
Yeah.
And then it's also very difficult to innovate. And that's kind of what we have here, right? You kind of got all these things went wrong. So all these rules were, guardrails were put into place until you can't really maneuver anymore. You haven't got much flexibility. Yeah. And especially when something, a new paradigm comes along, well, hang on, we can't move. So that's, that's the parallel I draw. Then when I look at blockchain and crypto, I think about blockchain, and I say this a lot, I think there's technical efficiency in blockchain, right? There's a special type of security layer there enabled through cryptography, and that enables us to do payment and delivery versus payment very efficiently, and then layer things like decentralized finance protocols on top, which is just super efficient, right? You talked about Aave and lending protocols, and these are just automated, and you can kind of trust them to the level of what the technology gives you, right? Which is this extra level of trust through the cryptography. And obviously a lot of developers will look at that and say, right, I don't need so much law anymore because I've got these technical protections. But that doesn't mean you don't need any, right? That's kind of where maybe some of the debate is, right?
Right. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, the other thing is, to the point you raised, and also to the SEC, I guess, is that technical efficiency is there. For me, that's really what we're aiming for, right? And when you talk about benefits to a society or to an economy, it's efficiency through innovation, right?
Yeah.
You can do things better, faster, cheaper, more securely, right? That's all, for me, that's always going to win at some point somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And it has done in every other area of technology, technical innovation. The thing that happened here, if I take the first two big blockchains, Bitcoin and Ethereum, Bitcoin started out, some software was deployed as a network, and then it started minting these coins, right? And at some point, somebody decided, okay, I'm going to sell this to somebody else, and they're going to give me something for it, right? And so they started trading, and then at some point, an exchange popped up. Ethereum did something slightly different. Ethereum said, we're going to create all these tokens, And if anyone wants to buy them up front, here they are, right? That difference, if you like, or that thing that Ethereum did at the beginning, that became the model for that. That's really what got everybody's attention and really drove the whole ICO market, right? It wasn't, oh, here's some technical efficiencies and so on. It was, oh, we can pre-sell tokens.
Totally.
And really, that's what effectively blew up the market, but also from a negative perspective, because that's, I guess, when the regulator came in and is saying, hang on, and a lot of things went wrong as well, because obviously a lot of people abused that.
It's true, and like on that efficiency point in particular, right? Regulators have lots of different mandates. I was just over at the London School of Economics, right? And I was basically telling, giving this lecture. Love the LSE, by the way. So shout out to anyone associated and affiliated with LSE. There, I was basically telling folks, like, look, a regulator has lots of different and increasing mandates, right? And that can lead to paralysis, as you mentioned. And then you have these market developments, and the market developments can lead to more efficient outcomes, like the technology stack, particularly when you get to blockchains and you get, again, that security layer, you know, the information layer, you know, the way in which information is both shared and communicated is can be very different, and depending on the circumstances can be very valuable. You know, how do you harness those points while at the same time, you know, some people, as has always been the case, whenever you have a new technology, there's always going to be someone who's going to think about, like, you know, what can I do to, you know, when it comes to trading, right? And I mean, like, literally from the telegraph, where you know that you can get a ahead of other people when you get trading information, you know, like all the way to the telephone, to the internet, and you know, like whatever the introduction of new technology is, it tends to create, you know, a new speculation is always going to be accompanying it. I mean, look at AI even right now. Like, you know, there's going to be a tizzy of sort of folks wanting to invest and to figure out how to not only build use cases, but also to sort of figure out where the wind is going to be blowing.
Change brings opportunity, right?
And change brings opportunity, right? So, and that's part of capitalism, right? I mean, that's kind of how our system is geared to work. But the problem is, you know, when and under what circumstances do you create something that has a negative externality for other people, right? And then, you know, and that usually happens in a number of cases. Either A, and this is what I always tell my law school students, whenever you're dealing with somebody else's money, right? Like, I don't care what anyone tells you, whenever you're dealing with somebody else's money, some kind of rule is involved, okay? Like somewhere floating around. Maybe it's like a clear rule, maybe it's like a fuzzy rule, maybe it's a thou shalt not rule, whatever it is, right? But I'm telling you right now, kids, whenever you're dealing with somebody else's money, there is something out there, right? And it's important to know kind of like what those things are and to be able to navigate them. I think that in the United States, our ecosystem is pretty weird. I always make this joke and I say Silicon Valley makes it, New York trades it, and DC regulates it, and they all can't stand each other. Yeah. So, you know, you have this, you know, these three poles of the Valley, DC and New York. And it kind of reflects a little bit of this tension, you know. But sometimes even if you're making it, if there's a financial application, you may not necessarily be aware or understand the market, the capital market in which the trading arises, and you may not understand the rules that apply, right? Meanwhile, if you're the trader, you may not really understand what you're trading, and you may forget.
And what I learned is you might not care, right? As long as it goes up or the direction that you want it to.
And you may not care. All you want to know is the direction of the asset. Exactly, right? You know, and then may not be aware of the rules. And then if you're like living in the regulatory space, you may not understand what it is, and you may not even know where it's trading or how it's trading, right? Like, yeah. Depending on.
Why, right? You may not understand why this is happening or whether there are benefits to it or not, and so on, right?
Yeah, you know, there is a, you know, there's not always, and this is like human nature, I think, that where you get people who are experts in something, right? You know, whether or not you're a software engineer and you just, you know, you know how to build that layer two, and you just know everything inside and out, you know, you may not always be as curious as to sort of what happens outside of that space. If you're the regulator and you just know your little rule subset 244, you know, you may not be that curious, right, about like what the technology looks like. And I think, it may be because I'm an academic, right? You know, sometimes I am surprised by the lack of curiosity in different sort of points of the ecosystem, and whether or not that is one of those challenges that's embedded in getting the rules right. But I think that, you know, maybe because I was watching ESPN earlier today, someone came up with a really good line. They said, money is undefeated, you know, and getting to your sort of efficiency argument, right? Like that ultimately, look, if you can create something with better value, with more efficiency and more security, you know, whatever constraints you throw up, you know, ultimately that's going to win, you know, and but those jurisdictions or markets or however you want to call them that don't recognize what will ultimately provide those services or don't enable those services to be created, however they may look. I'm talking about even more than crypto and blockchain or whatever right now, mm-hmm. right? You know, like they will lose. You know, the U.S. has had a pretty good track record over the last 100 years. You know, in terms of like just yeah. creating stuff that other people want and the technologies of the future. Other countries.
I mean, it's had tremendous, you know, the biggest companies. Okay.
But other countries are looking and they said, like, you know, Japan is looking around right now and saying, well, you know, we lost out on Web 2. You know, we want to be in the game when it comes to Web 3, you know, and so
Europe.
Europe.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? But yeah, no, but seriously, like, I mean, Europe is, you know, with Mika, now they have a lot to do. And, you know, a lot of people think like the story is over because you have Mika and there's 18 months of actual rule writing that will go along. But the fact that they can provide certainty and they're on the pathway to providing certainty and clarity is ultimately going to be helpful for consumers and investors to avoid shenanigans. But it's also going to be great for companies and founders and entrepreneurs that are looking to build something.
Yep. Amazing, amazing. Chris, do you think there's I think on the one side we have developers who can be super optimistic and, you know, they kind of believe in the code.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That's their world on the one side. We have regulators on the other who really just want the guardrails, right, in order for things not to go wrong on their watch, as you say. Is there a way of bringing these two worlds together?
I hope so, yeah. Right? You know, I think that, you know, I think that the folks who are developing the code, and, you know, they have to make sure that they go through the homework of sort of, again, understanding, you know, if they're frustrated with the rule, to ask themselves very, very, very seriously in terms of their product design, whether or not it be mm-hmm. on the user interface, because that's when like the consumer protection stuff will kind of pop in, or on the execution, depending on what the product is. That's where like, you know, the different kinds of rules will go in. Like, are you doing things that solve certain kinds of problems? So what I've told regulators in the United States, it's like regulators need to rethink all kinds of things that over the last 100 years, the concepts don't really work that well, right? Like, or you need to update. So there's something called materiality, like what's important and access to information, you know? And, you know, if you're working on a public sort of blockchain, a lot of the information is arguably 75, 80% of that information is pretty available.
That's what the coders would say. Right?
Right.
I mean, we wrote a report for a fund that wanted to put money into Terra Luna when it was all going up.
Yeah.
Right. And being a bunch of coders, we looked at the code and then we wrote a report that said what the code does and where it could go. Right. And the fund took one look at it and realized the money's not going in. Right. So from a coder's perspective, and actually the way that protocol worked was how it should. From a kind of blockchain perspective, right? The code wrote out what could happen, kind of what the rules were, and it did what it said on the tin, right? Just people didn't look very closely at the tin.
Right? So the question then is, right? So this gets to the next question then is like, what does sophistication mean, right? Mm-hmm. So in lots of trading environments, if you are considered to be, or investing environments, if you are considered to be a sophisticated investor, you can move a little faster. You're not constrained by the same kinds of constraints. Even your liability is, frankly, a little bit less from the standpoint of the issuer. But the way in which sophistication is defined largely is how much money do you have? And when you think about the developer community, I mean, yes, I'm sure, you know, there are a couple of like, you know, ridiculously, you know, billionaire-ish folks living on their islands. But then there are a lot of like normal people who are probably saying, well, I may not be super rich, but I can look at that code and say, this is not, you know, that something I want to put my money into, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to rethink what sophistication even means, right?
Yeah. I guess let me put it another way. As a techie, looking at this technology, the way I look at it, I would say that the technology brings you certainty in some areas where we didn't have certainty before.
Yeah. Right?
And then if I look at it from the regulator's perspective, the regulator has this list of risks, right? Or the list of things that have gone wrong in the past that they don't want to see go wrong again, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you probably want to do is you want to bring those two lists together, right? You want to say, here's all the things that have gone wrong in the past. With this technology implemented in a certain way, this risk goes away. That risk goes away. I need a way to make sure to make sure the technology is built is being used the way it should. But if it is, then you don't have to worry about these three things anymore. You still have to worry about these other five, right?
So you're absolutely right, man. And that's, you know, so believe it or not, that kind of thing doesn't naturally happen in government or policy, although it should, right? And I think that the most natural point for getting that done is you know, there are several, like, I mean, right now, you know, everyone's trying to figure out legislatively, you know, what goes on. And that's, you know, frankly, having one or two people who are the developers who understand things, you know, to participate in those conversations and say, here is what we, here's where you get more certainty. Here's where you get less certainty. Let's figure out something that actually is sustainable here. I think that, you know, and it, like when you think about what happens in the disclosure process, like when you start to write through what is material and what needs to be disclosed, et cetera, mm-hmm. that prompts action by regulators and others sometimes to like adjust what they are expecting, what they should be looking for, and what maybe isn't that important and what they have traditionally tried to emphasize, right? Like that's a natural mechanism for when those conversations can arise. But you are 100% correct that process, which is so rational and so intuitive, needs to happen. Why that has not happened, deserves a debate for like its own as to why frankly industry and regulators have not actually been able to successfully do that. I can't disagree with it.
It's still, you know, I appreciate it's still not that simple, right? I mean, to give an example, if there's a smart contract and it has three rules in it, and that's all it can do, then I know if I put my money in there and I see those three rules, those are the only three things that can happen with my money, and therefore I have that certainty, right? I guess that's where I come from as a techie and say, look, you don't need to regulate that thing, right?
Yeah.
It can't do anything that it's not that it doesn't say it's going to do, right?
Yeah.
So you don't need to enforce, you know, what do you need to enforce around that? But the reality is that people don't look at the code. There's a lot of marketing. There can be misinformation. Even among the technologists, you know, somebody will say something and they might be high profile, so we'll take their word for it. How many people will actually look at the code itself, right? And then you have all this misinformation floating around as well.
And they use different jargon, different kind of terminology. You know, one thing that, you know, it's not necessarily in what we call plain English, right? You know, those are challenges. But you know, to your point, which is kind of interesting, philosophically, I've said that the crypto space needs to be a little bit less in the securities mindset. Like, fine, if securities regulators want to go after it, that's fine. But when it comes to like, what is your mentality you should have when you look at this? Probably better for the consumer protection mentality than a securities law mentality, because you know you want to go for things that are short and sweet and to the point, right? You know, because that's what people are looking at. You know, what consumer protection people try to do is what you just said, right? Like when you have a new technology for lending in a bank, right? A lot of, you know, we have things like explainability, like requirements, et cetera. But it's not like what the regulator is ultimately trying to look for is just, what are the things that you're doing that's better? So let's say AI applications for lending, right? The mm-hmm. regulator will sit around, and I know for a fact that many of our regulators have sat around and said, does this improve underwriting? If the answer is yes, you know, tell me how it improves underwriting. Okay. Mm-hmm. What are the comparative advantages of this over, let's say, human-based underwriting? Fine. What are the, I see that you've gotten all this efficiency out of the, you know, into the system, I guess. You know, what are the comparative disadvantages now, based off of using the computers and, towards the human beings? And then you go through that. That kind of a process, interestingly enough, you'll see in banking a lot. But what you're not seeing right now, to the extent that you would have expected, when you're getting into other sort of blockchain based
crypto. Yeah, it could be it's probably maturity. Of just what's going on and how things have evolved, you know, and people's understanding of it and so on.
Very good point. You know, AI has been around for a while, you know, and so maybe they've had more time to get there.
Yeah, but I guess it's all, I mean, it also, you know, with crypto, we are playing with money, right? So
and sometimes other people's money. So
other
again,
people's money, and a lot of things can go wrong, and a lot of things have gone wrong, right? So obviously, that's what's taken all the focus.
And I think though that if you dig your heels in, and just say, oh, you know, nothing's wrong, you know, it makes it very hard. Again, getting back to my original point, for the regulator who sees nothing but downside, right?
Yeah.
Say, okay, let's take a risk and make a certain policy adjustment. I do think though, back to the money is undefeated sort of point, right? Like ultimately, the mainstreaming of the technology in whichever form. I mean, we can imagine like four or five different spaces and vectors where things can go. Will require adjustments, but it's sort of like the question of by the regulators, and things will you'll see lots of interesting new use cases and applications, but it is a question of like how painful are things going to be in terms of getting there, and which founders and entrepreneurs are at least aware of the fact that there are these sort of legal rails, right? And you want to kind of know what they are, even when you're trying to do the build. FinTech learned this, right? You know, like in the evolutionary path, like the FinTechs learned this, sometimes the hard way, but now it's like totally embedded very, very, very early on in their builds, just in a straight up sort of FinTech environment. And crypto will as well, although, you know, that's best and able to be done where there's clarity, you know? And so, we're talking earlier about the regulator shooting in the dark, you know, I had joked once before the US Congress when I was asked whether or not securities, what is a security? Is that clear? And I made the joke of saying, if that was the case, everybody would get an A in my class, which they don't, you know, so like, and so, you know, like how do you figure that out, is something that's going to be tough. But you know, founders have to at least be aware of sort of the broader parameters. And there are still going to be tons of opportunities for RegTech providers, for blockchain-based applications to solve problems. Yeah,
this is kind of the early days.
As well as just the normal larger economy, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I I'm not like a pessimist, but I do wake up more days than I'd like, sort of shaking my head and asking myself, how is it that we got here with this? Like, I mean, I, if someone would have told me 5 years ago that there was this, this much drama and, German, it's like, what the heck is going on in all this? Like, I'm like, you know, it, so,
so I hopefully that's all behind us, and now we can just get on the building and implementing.
It's super exciting. I mean, like the stuff that you're doing and building, like it's super exciting. But yeah, you know, like, is this an optimal environment? Of course not. Yeah, but you know, you do when you look longer term. You do see a space for some really, really interesting and creative and financially profitable and hopefully socially useful things that come down the pike. But it's going to be painful.
Chris, we're out of time. I've got one last question. And you're a professor, so I'm expecting a good answer to this one. So I usually ask the people I speak to recommend a book.
I've already said my fintech law in a nutshell for everybody. Yeah, if you need to know sort of like how the different stuff kind of works, suggest that, and I truly only say that because like the number of people who are like, hey professor, I use your book before a job interview, and I'm like, oh dear. I mean, I'm glad, but I don't know how I should feel about that. Yeah, you know, so if you're, but okay, I guess it's I suppose it's better than nothing. I think that for financial crises in history, my colleagues wrote a really great book called In Fed We Trust. And if you want to know like how the Federal Reserve works and how it became like an extra branch of the U.S. government and how this happened or, you know, the responses during the financial crisis, it's called In Fed We Trust. It's a great book. I actually assign it to my class before getting into anything legal about crypto. Okay. Even though there's not one word of crypto in the book, but it's good just to know the backdrop against which, you know,
where they were coming from. Okay.
Yeah.
I need to find time to read all these books.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great book. It's a great book.
Okay. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
Likewise.
And I hope we can do another one in the future and look back at all this and,
Yeah. Well, I also have to get you on my podcast. So you know, we're going to do that pretty soon. So, but it's a real pleasure, man, talking to you, and you know, also having the opportunity to learn from you.
Okay, fantastic, Chris. Thank you very much, man.
Cool. Thanks.
Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to the Applied Blockchain Podcast. Make sure you follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter for more updates. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, please let us know by leaving a review and clicking subscribe. Until next time,